Did you all know that Dr. King was invited to speak at our 1966 General Assembly? Yeah. There were a lot of connections, and, you know, I could preach on this for hours, and I won't. But there were a lot of connections between Dr. King and Unitarian Universalists and Unitarian Universalism. He and Coretta actually considered becoming Unitarian before merger, and there's a whole slew of reasons they didn't that had to do with movement building and how ineffective they thought they might be with their Black Baptist comrades and colleagues as Unitarian Universalists. That's another sermon. But there are a lot of connections. It's not like he just didn't know about us or we didn't know about him. And those connections led to his calling on us to join his people in Selma in 1965, the year before this lecture. There's also a lot in our congregation's history that led to such an overwhelming response to that call. Until 1965, I'm sad to say, our response to issues around race had not been particularly overwhelming. In his book, The Selma Awakening, happy to lend out, you'll hear more about it, the African-American minister and scholar of UU history, Mark Morrison Reed, points out that both Unitarians and Universalists were a lot better at preaching racial equality than they were at supporting it in the early 60s and before that. Of course, there were several exceptions. There was the Universalist missionary Quillen Shin, who actively supported the first Black Universalist minister named Joseph Jordan. Reverend Jordan did all these efforts to bring Universalism to the Black community of Norfolk, Virginia in the late 1800s, and he actually opened a school and ran it for a very long time. But the institution, the Universalist General Convention, was, as a rule, pretty quiet on matters of race, through the 40s especially, due in part to a prominent leader's vehement and vocal racial bias. Awareness of this inequity dawned slowly across the Universalist denomination, and public acknowledgement of the problem didn't happen until 1955. That was when an editorial called The First Year of Desegregation appeared in the Universalist Leader, their version of the UU World, which admitted that, quote, "We who talk about brotherhood must revise our policies and our practices to make brotherhood a reality in our parishes." And I do feel the need to say out loud that we're using a lot of gendered language today, because that is what was used in the 50s and 60s, and I chose not to change it. So also, the Unitarians, as well, with a few exceptions, they were also pretty quiet about racial equality. And the American Unitarian Association actively worked to block, or at least discourage, several of the Black men who were called to the ministry through the 1800s and early 1900s. Again, there were a few exceptions, like the Reverend Theodore Parker, a minister, a Unitarian minister of the mid-1800s, and an agitator and an abolitionist and a rebel and heretic in all kinds of ways. But even within being a staunch abolitionist, he was a racist. Even though he believed that slavery was immoral, he also believed that Blacks were inferior to whites, which was the common belief of the day. Other exceptions to Unitarian ambivalence were the Reverend Jenkin Lloyd Jones, who was a friend and ally to Frederick Douglass in the late 1800s, and the Reverend John Haynes Holmes, the minister of the Community Church of New York in the early to mid-1900s, who was a very, very active supporter of civil rights. But it was bits and pieces, individuals within the denomination, who were having this dawning awareness of the impacts of racism. So when the Unitarians and the Universalists merged together into one denomination, that happened in 1961, racial awareness was increasing around some of these people and the people they were talking to. And the newly formed association passed four resolutions rather quickly on their commitment to racial justice. At the same time, in 1963, they weren't able to pass an amendment to their bylaws that would require congregations wishing to be voting members in the association to have a non-discrimination policy. It was voted down in the name of congregational freedom. However, there was a Commission on Religion and Race formed as part of that effort, and that body started to do some real public and legislative work around racial justice, and the consciousness of UU laypeople and ministers began to be raised. Despite this dubious history, there was something about Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists that spoke to Dr. King. He was influenced by Henry David Thoreau's essay, Civil Disobedience, for example, which Thoreau wrote after spending a night in jail for refusing to pay his taxes, which was an act of civil disobedience to protest the Mexican-American War and slavery. After reading Thoreau's essay, Dr. King wrote that he was, quote, fascinated by the idea of refusing to cooperate with an evil system. He was also influenced by Theodore Parker, who was a central figure in the Transcendentalist movement like Thoreau, and who also agitated against the Mexican-American War. But unlike Thoreau, Parker sanctioned the use of violence for the sake of a worthy cause. For example, he harbored fugitive slaves, and he kept a loaded gun in his desk for use in their and his defense, if needed. He was also one of John Brown's secret six, who supported Brown's attempt to steal weapons from an armory in Harper's Ferry and use them in a slave rebellion. It was Reverend Parker from whom King got the idea of the arc of the moral universe bending toward justice. Reading in Parker's 1853 sermon, on justice and conscience. Parker wrote, I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I can see, I am sure it bends towards justice. And so, in March of 1965, when he called on clergy of all faiths to join me in Selma, as the telegram said, one of those telegrams went to the Unitarian Universalist Association's office. Dana Greeley, our association's president at the time, started making phone calls, and the people he called made more calls, and the call spread throughout the denomination. Dr. King also knew several UU ministers well enough to call them himself and ask them to come, and they went. While the institution of Unitarian Universalism had been slowly figuring out how to engage in the work of racial justice, its people, it turned out, had opened their hearts to the struggle and were ready to answer the call. Over 400 laypeople and 100 clergy went to Selma. I saw the movie Selma last week, along with a bunch of Reber's. And I was struck there by the same thing that I'm struck with as I read or hear the words that Pat shared with us today. I find myself wondering what has really changed, both in our denomination and in our nation. I know. Of course, there has been change. The legislation that Dr. King advocated for has happened. Segregation and discrimination based on race are illegal. Denying anyone the chance to vote based on race is illegal. Black people vote, they serve on juries, they have the right to be anywhere they want to be. Dr. King said, "The law cannot make a man love me, but it can restrain him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important also." And so, while the law may not change the hearts of men, he said, it does change the habits of men. And so our habits have, indeed, changed. But I'm not sure they've changed the way Dr. King envisioned, because I'm not sure our hearts have changed all that much. Beneath the changes in our habits, prejudice and fear of the other still lurk, and we still, and I'm using the royal we still operate within the racist system set up by our white forebears. And the habits, they're more subtle. They're harder to see. They're harder to call out. People of color and their white allies have more to prove when trying to shed a light on racism because it's gone behind the scenes, between the lines. Segregation is illegal. And I quote from the 2013 Dane County Race to Equity Report, Dane County black kids were estimated to be over 13 times more likely to be growing up in poverty than white children. Discrimination is illegal. And in 2011, 25.2% of blacks in Dane County were unemployed, while only 4.8% of whites were unemployed. 50% of black high schoolers graduated on time. 50%, compared to 85% of white high schoolers. 3,198 black students were suspended from Dane County public schools compared to 1,130 white students. And in 2012, the arrest rate for black Madisonians was 6 arrests for every 10 black residents and less than 1 for every 10 white, non-black, sorry. These statistics show racial disparities to be greater in Madison and Dane County than almost anywhere else in the country, and I know a lot of you are not surprised by that. But that doesn't mean they don't exist elsewhere. Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, writes, "More African Americans are under the control of the criminal racist..." Excuse me. More African Americans are under the control of the criminal justice system today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850. Discrimination in housing, education, employment, and voting rights, writes Michelle Alexander, which many Americans thought was wiped out by the civil rights laws of the 1960s, is now perfectly legal for anyone labeled a felon. And since many more people of color than whites are made felons by the system of mass incarceration, racial discrimination remains as powerful as it was under slavery or under the post-slavery era of Jim Crow segregation. So I'm still hearing Dr. King's warning, 50 years later, to not exaggerate our progress. I'm finding many parallels between the issues then and the issues now. Rap artist Common played Reverend James Bevel, who was the director of direct action and director of nonviolent education of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which King was a part of. He also co-wrote and performed the movie's anthem, Glory, with John Legend. And I want to give you a few lines from the song. I don't rap. But I'll give you the lines because the movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. Truant, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop and we ran up. There's still plenty to be maladjusted to. There are still people organizing around that maladjustment. I see the Black Lives Matter movement and its expression here in Madison in the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition as a current expression of that maladjustment, an heir to Selma, I might say. In his Golden Globe acceptance speech for the anthem in the movie, Common said, "I am the hopeful black woman who was denied her right to vote. I'm the caring white supporter killed in the lines of freedom. I'm the unarmed black kid who maybe needed a hand but instead was given a bullet. I am the two fallen police officers murdered in the line of duty. Selma has awakened my humanity. We look to the future and we want to create a better world. Now is the time to change the world. Selma is now. And so, our denomination has come a long way in talking about and engaging with racial justice issues. We came back from Selma in 1965 and promptly came to blows over the best way to serve our black members in the 1960s. We emerged, though, from that controversy, and it was long and painful. But we emerged, and we went on to form an identity group for people of color in 1997, the Diverse Revolutionary Unitarian Universalist Multicultural Ministries, or DRUM. And Allies for Racial Equity was formed in 2005 as a partner to DRUM. I'm on the Allies for Racial Equity Steering Committee, and I'd love to tell you more about that when I'm not in the pulpit and the work that we do. The story is not over, not by a long shot. There are still deep divisions in our association on how best to do the work of becoming an anti-racist organization. Just like not all the people of color agree with each other now or agreed with each other in King's Day on how to do the work. Not all us white folks agree with each other either. It's all still there. So at the end of Selma Awakening, Mark Morrison Reed tells his story about going to Selma in 2008 with a tour like the tour that several of us will be going on in the pilgrimage tour in March. And he closes out by saying, the protesters thought the struggle was about gaining the right to vote. It was that and much more. The moral battle was a continuation of the American Revolution, a yet unfinished revolution. The victory at Selma served as the catalyst of an economic and political revolution that led to an African American becoming president of the United States. King delivered many biblical phrases that held up a vision of freedom and justice, but even from the mountaintop, it was impossible to foretell that the vision would be fulfilled like this. Unitarian Universalists did not know that Selma would become a pivotal moment in their own history. In the past, our religious forebears had stood on the brink of making a difference in racial justice and had wavered, but not this time. Called, sent, drawn, or compelled, hundreds responded. When they left, there were two UU martyrs in their hearts, and there was conviction in their stride. They had been changed in ways their lives would reveal, but which words could never quite capture. It is not possible, Mark writes, nor necessary to know the outcome of our actions. Therefore, we act in faith. Faith asks not that we succeed, but that we try. We try because we yearn to live out our values. Conscience urges us on, for we have dreamed of a better, more just tomorrow. We care, therefore we act. Therefore, in acting, we risk having our hearts broken 1,000 times. Therefore, we are sustained by hope. That is the price those who cleared the way for us accepted. It is what living fully, deeply, and with integrity demands. May it be so, and may we make it so.